And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. Humans have not walked on the moon since Apollo 17 in 1972. Now, in Greek mythology, Artemis was the twin sister of Apollo. Artemis is also the name of the next moon mission where NASA will land the first woman and the next man on the moon by 2024. They'll be using innovative technologies to explore more of the lunar surface than ever before. Our next guest is Dr. Jake Bleacher, who is the chief exploration scientist of Advanced Exploration Systems, a division of NASA's Human Exploration and Operations Mission Directorate. Dr. Bleacher, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here, and thanks for having me, John Lynn. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Well, we're delighted to have you. This is such an exciting mission. Maybe you could take a couple minutes and sort of describe this mission, because there are several, there are a couple of flights that are before the actual landing on the moon. Maybe just tell us a little bit about the mission.
You're right. And first thing I want to relay is just your point about exciting times. This really is an exciting time. We're looking at an opportunity to put the first woman and next man back on the moon by 2024. And then after that, you know, establishing a sustainable presence through commercial and international partnerships. So this really is an exciting time for us. And, you know, you're exactly right. We talk about the Artemis program taking us to the moon for exploration and science. But we have a couple of flights that will occur before we actually have boot prints associated with Artemis. The Artemis 1 flight is going to be the first flight test of the space launch system that you mentioned, and the Orion spacecraft is going to be kind of the ferry for our crew. And that will be followed by the Artemis 2 mission, which will be the first time we actually have our astronauts on board the Orion launched by the SLS. So those two missions need to happen. Just like in Apollo, we had a few missions before we actually landed. Those missions really test out our systems. And then the mission that is going to be really exciting is Artemis 3. That's when we're going to land our astronauts in the south polar region of the moon. And that's really going to be some new and exciting stuff, because we have not visited that area of the moon in the past.
Now, Dr. Bleacher, most folks remember back to July of 1969 when the Saturn V took off and the lunar landing module separated from the crew capsule. The crew capsule continued to go around the moon while the lunar man module landed. This is a little bit different. We have something called a gateway. Can you describe the role of the gateway and what it is?
Sure. So you described the Apollo mission very well. We had a crew member stay in orbit while two crew members went to the lunar surface. And so we had that orbital module that stayed up there in orbit. The gateway is something similar, except we're, you know, when we go to the moon to explore, our goal is establishing sustainable presence. And to do so, we don't want to launch all of that hardware every single time. The gateway ends up being a module that is in orbit around the moon that we can reuse. It's kind of like an outpost that we have up there. So ultimately, the vision we have is that when we launch a rocket and we have the Orion getting our crew up into a lunar orbit, they can stop at that waypoint at the gateway. We can also send vehicles there that will then land on the moon. So that gives the crew a place to go. It gives a place for some of this hardware to go so it can dock with the gateway. We can conduct experiments at the gateway, both external payloads that are looking at the moon or looking out into deep space, studying the sun, for instance. We could have experiments that are inside. And in fact, some of the crew members who ultimately will go to the gateway and through the gateway to the lunar surface, we may have them stay in orbit as well. So it gives a place for those crew members to not just kind of hang out and wait for the lunar crew to get back to them, but they can conduct some experiments there as well. So the gateway is kind of that outpost, similar to Apollo staying in orbit, but it's one we can reuse for future missions.
Dr. Bleacher, that seems to be sort of the mantra these days about space exploration, reusing, and therefore creating a huge cost savings, first of all, but then it also shows the technology and, you know, the reuse of the rocket, you know, by SpaceX, for example, guiding it back to its landing spot and being able to reuse those rockets. It seems like that is a theme throughout space exploration. Is that right?
That is exactly correct. And in fact, that's a critical part to it. These partnerships that we're developing now with our commercial groups here in the United States, and also looking forward, partnering with our international partners. We really want to tap into that innovation, you know, both within NASA and outside of NASA. By really working with these groups and tasking them with tackling these complicated problems that are inherent to spaceflight, we really make sure that we get a robust system, something that's safe, something we can reuse, and as you mentioned, that helps us drive down costs so we can do more of the exploring and less of the just getting a piece up there.
Right. So NASA did a little update on the last year of a video update, the last year of this mission, and from naming it to talking about the milestones that you've reached in the Artemis mission so far. It's on YouTube. It's a couple minutes long. And funny, one of the comments says, "I'm so sick of the coronavirus. I want more news like this." You know, amen to that. But
I agree.
But a lot of people, you know, would say, "Wait a minute. We've already been to the moon. We know what we need to know about the moon. Why are we spending money on it?" And John and I have heard the explanation before, but I'd love to hear that from you.
Yes, you know, we have landed astronauts on the moon, largely in the equatorial region. And those were what we call sortie missions. So they landed one time at a place. They did a few tasks outside. Tremendous amount of knowledge was gained from the science. But then they returned. This is very different. You know, maybe you could think about something like Antarctica. Imagine if we had this discussion with Antarctica. We went once. We've been there. Why go back? Because it's expensive to go to Antarctica. But it's a part of our system, of our Earth system. It's a part of the world we live in. So too is the moon. It's part of the Earth-Moon system. Many things that happen in our daily life are dependent on the way the Earth and the moon interact. For instance, the tides. That's a part of our daily life. So now we go to the moon. We're going to the moon to establish a presence that is a foothold for us in establishing an ability to explore the solar system. So this is the location from where we will begin to learn how to survive in deep space, how to travel farther in deep space, and visit other destinations in the future, for instance, Mars. So, you know, the way I would look at it is not that we've been there, why go back? Apollo was just a first step in this pathway of human exploration of the environment around us.
I really enjoy that explanation because in our DNA, we are explorers. And for human exploration to Mars and beyond, we really have to work out some stuff first. And a lot of what's going to be going on in the Artemis program is really going to prepare us for Mars, isn't it?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, you asked about the Gateway. That's a place where we can start to learn what is the impact on the human body and to travel these long distances and long times to get out to Mars. You know, to travel to the moon, we're talking about several days. To travel to Mars, we're talking about many months. That is not something we've done in the past. And you can model that, and you can study it from data you collect out there. But at some point, we'll send the first people to Mars. In order to buy down the risk on that and make sure that we're protecting our crew as best as we can, we need to study that environment. And the moon is a great place where we can start that out. You know, the Gateway is a place where they can spend time off of a destination like the moon or the Earth that has gravity. They'll be exposed to the deep space environment so we can learn how to mitigate risks associated with radiation exposure, just long time periods on vehicles like that. And so we start that process with the ISS. We've been there for over two decades now continuously collecting that data. And so, you know, again, it goes back to my point that all of this is a pathway in advancing our ability for human exploration of the solar system that we're in. Then going down to the lunar surface, the moon is a rich scientific target in its own right. We're going to learn a lot about the moon, and learning about the moon helps us better understand the Earth. We'll also learn about how to operate in those types of environments, those hazard environments, which will also contribute to understanding how and what do we need in order to travel out to Mars and explore Mars as well.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Jake Bleacher. He's a planetary geologist, but he's also the chief exploration scientist for NASA. And I wanted to ask you, Jake, the being the science advocate for NASA technology and architecture and to the moon, deep space, and beyond, but you also are a geologist. And we, of course, have to do proper mapping of Mars to find the right sites to land and explore and those sorts of things. Understanding volcanic history of the Earth is challenging enough. How do you understand Mars volcanic history when the red planet is somewhere between 78 and 140 million miles away?
That is a great question. And I can go stand on my back porch and look at the sky and I can see Mars. You know, it's a slightly reddish colored dot up there in the night sky. But we also have the ability to develop telescopes, to build spacecraft, to launch those spacecraft, to go to orbit and even land on the surface of destinations like Mars and the moon. So we get this perspective, ever-increasing detailed perspective of the destinations that we have in mind. And then we can start to make some assumptions that similar processes at the moon and at Mars operate similar to how they operate here on Earth. So, for instance, because of chemistry, we know that the volcanic rocks on both the moon and Mars are similar to the types of volcanic rocks that make up the floor of our oceans here on Earth. And in some locations, like Hawaii, or if you're in Europe, Mount Etna, have a similar composition, a similar chemistry or makeup. And so we can go to those locations here on Earth and study the processes, understand what we're seeing, the active process that makes a product. And then we can look at a place like Moon or Mars, where we see that final product, and we can begin to infer the processes that led to what we see. And that works for a range of processes. So at the moon in the South Polar region, this is a heavily cratered terrain. The South Pole of the moon has been hit from projectiles from deep space forever. And so what we see are a bunch of craters or holes that get formed during those collisions. Well, we see those here on Earth as well. In the state of Arizona is a great one, Meteor Crater. So we can go to destinations just like that here on Earth to help us think about and prepare for and ask the right questions for exploring and understanding the science at these targets.
Mm, I love that. So going back to the Apollo mission and the rocks that were collected from the surface of the moon, when they came back and planetary geologists such as yourself, but obviously, you weren't doing this sort of research at that point. But what were the biggest questions that came out that, you know, if only we could go back to the moon, these are the things we would want to find out? And how do those questions remain in your mind today?
Well, I'm glad that you scheduled me for a 5 to 6 hour conversation here, because that's a long answer. I'm kidding.
We'd love to talk to you.
We'll talk offline, but there are a number of themes of different types of questions gained from what we learned during Apollo. And I think that just points to the fundamentals of science, right? Is that everything we learn helps us to better ask the next question. You know, we don't go and pick up a rock and now we know the answer. We pick up a rock that helps us ask a better question about moving forward and understanding that place. I think what I would really like to draw your attention to is what we've learned since Apollo. Apollo was a good baseline for us and really advanced our understanding of the moon. But for instance, right now we're opening samples for the first time that were collected during Apollo. They had the foresight back then to recognize that, you know, technology advances in leaps and bounds, and the instruments they had at that time might not be sufficient to get the data they wanted. And so now we're actually opening some samples for the first time. It's almost like sending a whole new mission to the moon in its own right. But some of the orbiters, and we've also had a spent stage on a vehicle from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter called LCROSS that crashed into the South Polar region. The combination of these data have suggested to us that there are volatiles, or more specifically, water in the South Polar region of the moon. And so when we say that we've already kind of made up our mind that we're going to the South Pole. This is one of the big reasons. We think there's water there. That water is going to be able to tell us about the history of the solar system. Some of that water may be from the moon or the Earth early on in their history. Some of it is likely delivered from comets. And so getting that water will help us understand some of that early history of the Earth and the solar system. In addition to that, water is one of those resources that if you can find it along the way, instead of having to bring all of it with you, it saves you a tremendous amount. Water is really heavy. It's one of the heaviest things that we have to carry. And so if you can go there and there's water there, just like if you're going on a multi-day hike, if you can find a spring or there's a well where you can get water and you don't have to carry it all on your back, that's a tremendous advantage. So the questions we have, especially about the volatiles, the water history on the moon, those are things that we didn't even have the ability to ask the right questions at the end of Apollo. But that hard work by the scientists decade after decade have led us to the position where we are right now.
That's so interesting about the water. So are we talking also, when we talk about water on the moon, being able to, I mean, a big part of this is placing astronauts on the moon and the sustainability surrounding humans being there. Is that part of the sustainability? I mean, do we know yet whether or not the water is good for human consumption?
That is a really important question. First of all, the earliest resource that we're going to take advantage of in the South Polar region is light. The axis of the moon is not tilted like it is here on Earth, so we don't really have the significant seasonal impacts on the moon. And what happens is that the poles, there are these craters I talked about, are basically just big holes in the ground. Some of the floors of those craters never see the light of day. And so that's where we think a lot of the water has been trapped, because it hasn't had a chance to be evaporated or burned away by the solar wind. But just like you have places that are eternally dark in the lower areas, at the higher areas on ridges or the peaks of mountains, you have places that might see light for 80% of the year, 90% of the year. So that we can take advantage of, because that's probably how we'll generate our power initially, is solar power. Also, it helps us design our systems. If you don't have to experience 50% of your time on the moon in that darkness, in that extremely cold darkness, you can design systems that take advantage of that light. From there, we can then begin to explore the moon and answer the types of questions you just asked. So before we send crew, we're already going to be sending robotic explorers. So we have something called CLPS, or Commercial Lunar Payload Services, that's funded out of our Science Mission Directorate. They're sending landers, robotic landers, to the moon that are starting to explore ahead of the crew members. And we just recently announced a small rover that's going to go and kind of sample different locations and determine what the status of the water is. So we can start making a plan as to, can we use this? Can we access this? How will this resource benefit us? And then if we can, that becomes a part of our future strategy and helps enable that sustainable vision we have.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Jake Bleacher, who's the Chief Science Exploration Scientist for NASA. We are talking about going back to the moon, about exploring Mars and exploring beyond. I just want to mention, we're going to get a lot of help from folks in Utah to do all of this. I mentioned at the top of the show that two solid fuel boosters that are part of the Space Launch System are manufactured by Northrop Grumman in Ogden, Utah. If you remember our conversations with Charlie Precourt, who's the VP of Propulsion Systems for them. Also, here in Park City, Triumph Gear Systems will be providing components for the SLS launch system, as well as dozens and dozens of other contractors in Utah. We'll be doing a separate show on their part in all of this. Jake, I got a tough question for you.
Okay,
here we go. So, and you can go anywhere you want with this. What one question would you want answered that has not been answered yet as it relates to our exploration of the moon, Mars, and beyond?
Ooh, that's really tough, because now you're you're pitting my personal interests against my my job role. So I'll try to answer that from two perspectives. The job that I have is to try and make sure that the systems we build for human spaceflight are designed in a way that they meet the science objectives that are given to us by our counterparts in the Science Mission Directorate, or our international partners, or even our commercial vendors who have some science goals. So, you know, really big questions that I would like to see addressed is if we can figure out exactly how much time we have in the daylight or how quickly we can move. The neat thing about the sun moving around the shadows of the South Polar region is if you can move a vehicle around, you could actually maybe stay in the sunlight all the time. And so we have a lot of questions just about the surface properties in the South Polar region that will really help us optimize the systems we're building. And to me, in my role right now, those are the most important questions that we can deal with. And so I spend a lot of my time dealing with that. Now, if you're asking me to step back and be a scientist with my own personal interests, you already noted that I study volcanoes. Of interest to me is just understanding the difference between the Earth, the Moon, and Mars, and how volcanoes operated at these different locations. For instance, the Earth is still active. We have volcanic eruptions here now. We do not believe that there are any volcanoes erupting on either Mars or the Moon. We haven't seen evidence of that. But the closer we look suggests to us that maybe they have experienced them not too long ago. Now, when I say not too long in geologic sense, that could be millions of years, tens of millions of years. But it suggests that maybe those planets, the Moon, aren't thermally dead. They're not thermally exhausted. And so that's really exciting because as we understand life to exist here on Earth, it requires several things, access to water, it needs energy. And so if you have places where you can start to meet those criteria, now you're talking about places where maybe if life isn't there now, it may have had a foothold in the past. And so understanding the history of the thermal conditions of these destinations in the solar system, how they pair and overlap with access to water and volatiles, those are the types of big questions that really help us drive at, you know, the main goal for NASA, which is understanding, are we alone in this big expansive universe or not? And so to me, that's really what's exciting. And with my job, I'm able to help make sure that the human exploration part that we're developing is done in a way that enables our scientists and future generations to try and help answer those questions. So that's to me a very fulfilling thing that we're doing right now.
Jake, Mars has an atmosphere, but it's only 1% of what we have here. I'm really looking forward to, as I understand, you're going to be sending a drone helicopter to Mars to see if we can get that to fly. And if it can, that's really going to help us understand that planet.
Yeah, you're right. And I'll point back to my discussion about the South Polar region of the Moon for Artemis, and that mobility is very important. So on Mars, we've sent rovers, and you may know some about the history of that exploration. But those rovers, they move at a certain speed. We have to be very careful with them. They collect a tremendous amount of very detailed data that helps us understand the history of Mars. But we'd love to move faster. And that, in essence, is why we want to send our astronaut, right? Because they can walk, they can move fairly quickly. So going to a planet like Mars and trying to design systems that take advantage of the atmosphere, however thin it might be, to increase our mobility, that gives us a chance to make real-time decisions about exploring a place. And you may have a plan in mind when you go to explore something, but as soon as you start learning, just as we talked about earlier, the whole process of science is collecting data so that you can ask better questions. And as soon as you learn something when you get to a place like Mars, you might realize you're not asking the right question right now. Now you need to go over there to get the better data. And so having that mobility will certainly increase our ability to study Mars and ask good questions.
Well, you know, we talked in the introduction about the launch being in 2024. Do you have any, quickly, what are the considerations for exactly when it will happen in 2024, or is that certainly the year that it will happen?
Well, that's when we're going to be launching to go to the moon, and the vice president gave us that goal. So we're sending crew to the moon in 2024, and we do have a lot to think about. We're working with our commercial partners. They're providing us with solutions to create the systems that go there. And I think, you know, that's the exciting part right now, is evaluating these opportunities. And so we're learning, along with our commercial partners, about how we'll do that. And that will be what enables us to be there by 2024 and then on forward after that.
Dr. Jake Bleacher, Chief Science Exploration Person for NASA. Jake, you got a promise to come back and talk to us again.
Hey, you just let me know. I really enjoy having the opportunity to chat with everybody. Thank you very much.
Yeah, listen, thank you
for being on
Cool Science Radio, and continued success with Artemis.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jake.